From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Some things that define the South are also pretty bad for us. For example, fried chicken and cheesy grits. Here's Morehouse College professor Mark Lamont Hill on the soul food his family ate.
My whole family has suffered from bad eating. They've all suffered from eating pig's feet and chitlin and frying everything and putting hot sauce on everything and putting an extra bag of sugar in the Kool-Aid. I mean, everything that you could imagine I'm part of, I come from that tradition.
Soul food was first developed because blacks were poor for the most part and they needed to make the ingredients they had taste better. The South has actually long faced issues of poverty, and that's led to a pretty troubling discovery about the health of Southern people. We'll talk about all of that today. First, though, let's return to a conversation about chess we had last week. Paul Hoffman of the Liberty Science Center joined us to talk about the appeal of chess to kids from all backgrounds.
The thing about chess is that you see yourself getting better very quickly. That things that you couldn't understand and seemed totally befuddling about how the pieces interact, that the next week when you play, suddenly you see this kind of clarity. And that's very empowering to people. And it's the only game I can think of, or sport, if you can call it a sport, where if a five-year-old sits down to play an 80-year-old.
Here are your first thoughts. Momir Radovich left us this message on Facebook. In chess, he says, the problem arises at the very beginning. We start teaching the moves. Funny thing, chess is a game of war, yet power, how to organize and use force purposefully, is neglected. Memorization of the moves is there, while comprehension and meaning is out, which discourages the beginner so many, too many, simply walk away from the game. All its benefits stay elusive. We need a deep-down paradigm shift in the way we teach the basics of chess or math or tennis. It's not how you hit the ball, it's where you hit it. It's all mindset. See, our listeners are deep thinkers, I'm telling you. We love to hear what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or Facebook.com/On Second Thought Radio. And, of course, we might feature your comments on the show. So here's the good news for Atlanta soccer fans. The city will soon have a Major League Soccer team called the Atlanta United FC. The bad news is the city's existing team, the Atlanta Silverbacks, are coming to an end. Joining me to talk about this are two local soccer enthusiasts. Doug Robertson is a sports reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, Doug.
Hey, how are you?
Good to have you. Also with us is Jorge Alonso. He's with the Atlanta soccer support group, Terminus Legion. Hi, Jorge.
Hey, how are you?
So when you say soccer support group, what does that mean? What does your group do?
Well, in our case, Terminus Legion, we were created to support soccer at all levels in Atlanta. The idea is basically what you see in European stadiums, those fans that are chanting and jumping and singing throughout the entire game. That is basically what we are, with a local focus.
But you also have, to a certain extent, kind of a lobbying component, trying to convince people that soccer is popular in Atlanta and that it belongs here and is a good sport for the city?
Correct, yes. Historically, it hadn't been part of the mainstream culture, if you will. So we are also engaged in bringing people together to actually watch the sport, enjoy it, learn about it, and actually come to the games.
Okay, so we're going to hear from you on how you feel about all this sort of bittersweet news. But Doug, first, can you explain to us why we're losing the Atlanta, most likely losing the Atlanta Silverbacks?
Because the NASL, the league the Silverbacks were in, the North American Soccer League, couldn't find an owner for the franchise. There were several interested parties, but they could never come to an agreement. The schedule was about to come out, and once the league realized we're in it too deep, we can't find an owner in time, they just had to pull the plug
now
on the franchise.
Some of their statements said they couldn't find a suitable owner. What does that mean?
I imagine someone who wants to put in enough money and take care of the maintenance of the team, playing at either Silverbacks Park or at another location in Atlanta. Even the NASL is, you know, it's modestly expensive for that tier of professional sports.
So what's the difference between the North American Soccer League and Major League Soccer?
Major League Soccer is considered the top tier of professional soccer in the United States and Canada. The NASL is considered, it would argue, but is considered kind of the second tier of professional soccer in the United States. The payrolls aren't as large. The talent, in some cases, isn't as great. The venues aren't as nice. And it doesn't have the TV contracts that MLS has.
Okay, so Jorge, on balance, things are still good for soccer in Atlanta?
Yes, yes. We feel 2016 is going to be a great year for us. We are refocusing our efforts, but part of our commitment has been to support soccer at all levels, like I said before. We will continue doing that. Sadly, we won't have the Silverbacks in their incarnation in the NASL, but we will continue to have many other soccer expressions in Atlanta, so we will be there.
Did you think the Silverbacks were a good team?
We loved them.
That's not the same thing.
Well, you can have arguments in either direction. They had a great run in the Open Cup in 2014, for example, and we were there supporting them. 2015 was a year in which they struggled. They had a good moments throughout the season. It was not a successful season from the results perspective, but we feel that they did, for us, for Terminus Legion, we were able to bring more people to the game and get more people excited about soccer. So in a way, for us, it was successful. From the results standpoint, not as much.
Doug, there's been a conversation going on about whether or not the creation of our new Major League Soccer team here in Georgia is the reason why we couldn't find a suitable owner for the Atlanta Silverbacks. Would there have been enough fans here to support two teams?
Oh, yeah. I think easily there would have been enough fans. I think it's incorrect to think that the Major League Soccer team killed the Silverbacks. There are a lot of different factors that affected the Silverbacks, but the Major League Soccer team coming in, I don't think really had much to do with it at all.
So why couldn't we find an owner then?
You'd have to ask them that.
There's no discussion. There has to be conspiracy theories. There always is in sports.
Yeah, conspiracy theories are fun, but they're not always factual. I think it's just someone who wanted to put the money in. It comes down to the income from revenue versus the cost of the operations. The Silverbacks, playing at Silverbacks Park, which is owned by Boris Drakunica, who is a managing partner of the Silverbacks until the NASL took it over. He gets a lot of the revenue from the parking and from things like that. And so those are revenue streams that if you were to play at Silverbacks Park, you're not going to get. So you've got to find another place to put the team. And there's only a few places in Metro Atlanta that could probably host them, Kennesaw State being one. And now that they've got football and there's lacrosse and some other things up there, it becomes kind of a puzzle that just has a few missing pieces.
Jorge, let me then ask about the support for soccer. I wonder why Atlanta is a city that has such a large number of soccer fans. Have you thought about that? Because, I've been in other cities. Soccer hasn't quite caught on in the United States yet. But in Atlanta, people don't realize how many soccer fans there are here.
That's true. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Atlanta has been touted as an international city. And in many ways, it is. I grew up outside of the United States. We never really saw Atlanta in that light from there, not just for soccer, but in general. When I moved here, I found that there is a lot here that is not normally seen from outside of Atlanta, soccer being one of the things. When the new team that's coming, the MLS team, was announced, certain groups were created to follow them. It is impressive that this team has been able to secure somewhere around 25,000, I think it's probably higher at this point, deposits for their first season, just the season tickets. That will tell you there is an incredibly big community, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Atlanta is a transient city. For many people, this is not where they were born. This is not where they grew up. You have people from all over the world moving here, and that brings more and more fans. I am one of them.
So, Doug, does that make sense to you? Does that sound like a reasonable explanation for why we have so many soccer fans here?
Oh, yeah, it's a perfect explanation. I grew up in Atlanta. I grew up in Mableton near Six Flags. I grew up with the Atlanta Chiefs, the first professional soccer team in the city, the first to actually win a championship, a league championship, before the Braves, the Falcons, the Hawks, everybody else. And so that's how I got into soccer. So it's a mix of those of us who grew up with the Chiefs and those who have moved in, who were already soccer fans. Atlanta United has almost 30,000 season ticket deposits at this point. They're soon, they said hopefully by the end of February, are going to announce their season ticket prices. And if they are perceived to be reasonable, then that number could get even higher. kind of further cementing the fact that Atlanta likes soccer.
Yeah, and they're going to be playing in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. What kind of stadium do we know that might be for soccer, particularly as opposed to football?
Well, it's going to be brand new. It's allegedly going to be one of the best stadiums in the world. It's going to have all this cool technology. If they get past 30,000 season ticket deposits purchased, I think they're going to have to open up the upper bowl of the stadium. It's two bowls, a lower and an upper bowl. So that'll be interesting. I know they want to pack it out for the first few games at the very least, which would be 70,000, I think. So it should
pack
be a fun
it out.
Experience.
Let me. You mean that not open the upper tier so that they can have sold out crowd? Is that
no,
what you mean?
Yeah, open the upper tier so that the entire stadium is sold out. I mean, Orlando did it for its first couple of games, and I know that Arthur Blank is a competitive guy, or he wouldn't be in professional sports. So I can imagine that they're really going to push to try to sell out as many of those games as they can.
And Jorge, do you have expectations that possibly the soccer team could be more winning than the baseball, basketball, or football team?
Well, if you go by Arthur Blank's words during the announcement, absolutely. He's in this to win it. So, yes.
And so far, everything that you've seen in terms of hiring staff and players, you're happy with?
Oh, yeah. They are building a world-class team. We have no reason to believe that they wouldn't continue doing the same thing.
Doug, you agree with that? World-class team?
They have aspirations to build a world-class team. I think it's a little too early to say that because they haven't signed any players yet.
Right.
But they do have – the front office guys that are hiring do have very impressive resumes and are very knowledgeable about soccer. Darren Eales worked in England for many years with West Bromwich Albion and Tottenham Hotspur, two Premier League teams. The Premier League is considered the best in the world. Carlos Bocanegra is a U.S. men's national team player, capped more than 100 times, former captain of the team. Those guys are smart. They recently hired a guy from Orlando City to help run the team, bringing his experience. So the pieces are falling into place, but now they've got to start signing some players and hire a coach, which are kind of the most important things.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the short time that we have left, Jorge, I assume you're one of the season ticket holders for the Atlanta United?
I am one of the deposit holders at this point. We will see what the team will do in terms of pricing. But like Doug said, if it's something affordable, absolutely, I will be. And I will have three of them.
So as we say goodbye to the Silverbacks, is that a tragedy?
It was for us. On a personal level, for many of us, it was the first professional team that I followed here in Atlanta. The day they announced that they were folding, I actually had to consult my crying wife over this. For a lot of people, this was their first team. And from Terminus Legion, we brought to the stadium a lot of people that had never followed the team. We were there every single game. We created personal relationships with the players. So for us, it was a tragedy. It's a tragedy we have learned from. And like I said earlier, we will continue moving forward.
That is Jorge Alonso. He's the Director of Brand Development with the Atlanta-based soccer group Terminus Legion. We also spoke with AJC reporter Doug Robertson. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. Here in the South, a good portion of what we eat falls into the category of soul food, or at least inspired by soul food. Dishes like fried okra, pickled pig feet, black-eyed peas, those are all staples for many Southerners, particularly African Americans. As much as soul food is known to bring people together at the table, though, it can also wreak a pretty tough pinch on families. That was filmmaker Byron Hurt's experience. He's originally from Milledgeville, Georgia, and he's behind the documentary Soul Food Junkies, which is now streaming on Netflix. Hey, Byron.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Before we get into this discussion about soul food and the addiction to it, what does it mean to have your documentary now streaming on Netflix?
Oh, well, that's a really big deal for me. You're not really a filmmaker nowadays unless your film is on Netflix. So it's an important way to get the film out there and to have people have access to it. It's now a major distribution platform that Everybody associates in terms of the name recognition, so it's very important.
So let's bring into this conversation two experts in food. Shade Anderson is the African Heritage and Health Program Coordinator with the nutrition nonprofit group Old Ways. Good morning, Shade.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And we had to bring in a dietitian to tell us exactly how bad fried chicken is. Connie Crawley will do that for us. She lives in Athens, where she worked for the University of Georgia Extension for a number of years. Hi, Connie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. First, Byron, do you still connect your father's death with eating soul food?
No, I do not. Not solely soul food. I think my father's illness was probably determined by a number of different factors. Some of them are unknown, and some of them probably could be linked to diet and lifestyle. But I think that's the point of the larger film. Like the larger story of the film is my journey to better understand our connection to soul food, our emotional connection, our historical connection to Southern food, which then became known as soul food. And also not just personal eating habits, but some of the structural, systemic issues that affect people of color and poor people in terms of access to healthy quality food.
But either Shade or Connie, I bet you can answer this question. And let me go to you first, Connie. One of the things Byron suggests in the film is that there's the possibility of addiction to a certain kind of food. And it seems that recent studies have supported that in some way. I mean, some studies have confirmed that high fat, high calorie foods affect the brain in the same way that cocaine and heroin does, right?
Well, certainly we do acquire taste for certain flavors, and those flavors, unfortunately, in soul food are related to fat content and salt content and sugar content, and all of those three things have been connected with almost all the chronic diseases that we see in this country. So it is an acquired taste. It can be adjusted, but people have to make a commitment to make that adjustment.
And yet it's really difficult, Shade, to change people's habits, because some of it is cultural and some of it has to do with family. In the documentary, Byron spoke with Morehouse College professor Mark Lamont Hill, and he talked about his experience growing up with soul food. He says he's tried to live a healthier lifestyle, but he says it is not easy.
I keep hot sauce in my bag just in case some fried chicken pops off. I love it. You know what I mean? That's how I live. But I have to make a choice and say, okay, today I have to make a different choice because yesterday I made a bad choice. And I try to regulate myself. But it's a work in progress. It's like somebody who's trying to get off of like crack or heroin or something. I'm trying to wean myself off fried chicken, man.
Shade, I mean, that sounds funny, but how much truth is there to that?
Absolutely. We see our participants in our A Taste of African Heritage cooking series that they, too, are coming with this experience. The challenges in wanting to change your palate. But our cooking series has seen great improvements in people's healthy behaviors, but also biomarkers. Through the 6 lessons, people are being exposed to an abundance of vegetables, whole grains, legumes, herbs, and spices that they may or may not be familiar with, and using healthy oils and healthy food preparations to make the foods that they already enjoy, but just making them healthier. And so post the 6 lessons, we see that people are eating more of those things regularly, cooking more, eating fresh more, and it has greatly improved their blood pressure, their weight, their waist circumference.
Yeah. Let me take this to Byron, because Byron, I found it interesting the reasons why many people that gave you for why they like soul food so much. Let's listen to a minister, Abdul Hafiz Muhammad. He's with the Nation of Islam, and the Nation of Islam actually has programs. They have messages designed around trying to get people to eat healthier. So this was pretty funny.
Soul food restaurants don't turn me on. What turns me on today is a nice salad, you know, with different kinds of lettuce and roughage that will clean out your colon. The different kinds of the onions and the beets and the carrots and things of that nature that make things healthy. I like healthy living today.
No fried chicken?
Well,
no fried chicken.
Hard giving up that fried chicken.
Byron, tell me about what did people tell you? Why is it so hard to give that stuff up?
Well, I think there's a real strong emotional connection to the food that they grew up with in their homes, cooked by their grandmothers, their grandfathers, and aunts and uncles during holidays and family get-togethers, family reunions, and that sort of thing. So I think a lot of people who grew up with the soul food tradition do not want to give it up. And then there's also the taste. I mean, soul food cooked in a certain way, in some of the more unhealthier ways, is tasty. I mean, it's hard to beat the taste of soul food, and that's one of the reasons why people love it so much. But, you know, as the film suggests, you can continue to maintain the soul food tradition by preparing the food differently with healthier oils, as it was mentioned, and, you know, not cooked with certain fatty foods whatever the food that you're cooking, and still enjoy some of those Southern traditions that we are accustomed to.
So then let me take that to you, Connie. Does soul food get a bad rap? I mean, you can cook greens with bacon grease, but you don't have to, right?
Well, yes. The best thing about soul food is the fact that it does usually use a lot of vegetables, and that is something that is a positive. It's just how the vegetables are prepared. The real issue I see with soul food is that it contains a lot of meat, and unfortunately a lot of that meat is a high-fat meat that was less expensive, so people use that. So the real issue is, can you cut back on the meat, or can you switch to a leaner meat? And then can you cut back on the amount of seasoning by using alternative seasonings, such as herbs and spices that aren't high in sodium, or lemon or wine or some other seasoning that would be a lot more healthy for the person. But many people really have lost the skills of cooking anymore. You know, my clients that I see that are African American, they're not making soul food because soul food takes a long time to cook. They're having it at holidays mainly, but they're usually eating out a lot or eating a lot of convenience foods. And those are not necessarily soul food restaurants that they're going to, but they're getting what would be high-fat, high-sugar, high-salt foods in either fast food places or family restaurant-type places that sometimes have what would be considered soul foods that are now on the menu that are not necessarily soul food restaurants.
And this is something, actually, we got a tweet from a listener. The Davil says, I'm eager to hear the soul food segment, but I just want to say, soul vegetarian, 2 in Atlanta, 1 in Tally, great food and good for you. And this is also something that you talked about in the documentary as well, Byron. We hear from chef and food activist Bryant Terry, who talked about this very thing.
The most important thing is that people complicate their understanding of what soul food is, because it's easy to say that it's the bane of African-American health. The bigger cause of the decline of African-American health is the industrialization of our food system 4 or 5 decades ago. The goal of these corporations that are producing food is to make it cheap, to make it fast, to make it convenient.
So, Sade, we're talking about an issue perhaps that is not just about soul food and eating grits with a lot of cheese, but just about the fact that, like Connie says, people aren't cooking for themselves anymore?
Right. I agree. We definitely live in a fast food world. And so Old Ways, a Taste of African Heritage program, is trying to get people back into the kitchen and create a new relationship with food. As everyone mentioned, the healthier oils, the spices, the herbs, using those instead of the excessive amounts of salt and sugar to flavor your foods. Know that you don't have to put, as you said, cheese or meat in all of the vegetables. Our program is completely plant-based for the 6 lessons intentionally, because we know that people of African descent are eating excessive amounts of meat and dairy, and we know that that's causing the high rates of food-related food illnesses, and so diabetes, high blood pressure, etc.
Yeah.
So we intentionally made it plant-based to know that you can prepare collard greens delicious without the ham hocks. You can make okra without frying it. You can make stewed black-eyed peas, sweet potatoes, just by baking them. You don't have to add anything.
So this brings us, Byron, back to you, and especially back to some of the reasons your dad had trouble giving up soul food. And that was because he didn't really want to embrace change. He wanted the food made exactly the way his family had made it for generations. And I wanted to play this clip from the documentary with Chantel Lewis, who's a curator of African diasporan history and culture, explaining how far back the roots go that connect people to this food.
New Orleans is a very African city with, I would say, a thin French veil. The first wave of African people were coming from the Senegambia region of West Africa to New Orleans. Something else that these people brought was okra, which gumbo is actually the West African word for okra. And so the women, when they were disembarking off of the slave ships, people were finding seeds in their hair, and they were actually okra seeds.
Byron, help me understand why people felt such a strong pride in this type of food.
Well, back during slavery, where enslaved Africans or Africans who were enslaved and then brought over to the Americas lost a lot of personal control and institutional control, and food was one way that we could regain control over our lives and sort of invent a culinary style or tradition that we could lay claim to and be very proud of. And I think that's one reason why, we hold on to it so strongly. I do want to clarify something I said earlier about my father. I do think that my father was addicted to food. He loved food, and I think that he did not eat food in moderation and did not have a balanced diet. I can't say for sure 100% that it led to his pancreatic cancer. But I think the larger point is getting back to this connection that people have to food and food being cooked and prepared in a particular way that is not for us. And I think, as the guests have suggested and stated, that what we believe is the best approach is to change our palates by cooking and preparing food differently, so that we can benefit from some of the natural tastes and the natural flavors and the natural nutrition that these foods provide. I cook at home every single day, and I cook things like kale, collard greens, beans and legumes, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, baked fish, and salads. And I believe that all of these things fall very neatly into the tradition of soul food, but the preparation is different, and I experience the health benefits that come along with eating these foods in a very healthy way.
So let's actually listen to your dad's voice. This is he passed away, but there's a clip of him in some archival footage that you include in the film.
Under the system of Jim Crow and segregation, probably many people before me had to learn some coping skills. And doing this, they did not necessarily have to surrender their dignity, but they had to find ways, viable ways, tenable ways of getting their needs met without sacrificing our dignity.
So, Connie, before we go away from this segment saying that soul food is basically the dietitian's devil, can you help us understand whether or not soul food is deserving of the blame that it gets? And we've talked a lot about how to get those flavors without all of the fat. Is that a difficult case to make to people who've had, say, collard greens prepared with bacon fat for all their lives?
Well, they have to experiment with it, and they have to experience it. And that's why cooking schools and various demonstrations that can be done for people can convince them that it may taste different, but it doesn't taste bad. And, you know, what we find is that the average person eats about the same 18 to 20 recipes over and over again, or 18 to 20 foods over and over again. And if you can get them to change one of those foods each month, in a year, they are a totally different person. But it is hard to make them see the value of doing that. And it especially is hard when the person hasn't yet had the really serious consequences of their lifestyle habits. So, you know, it is hard. Food and exercise are the two hardest things to change in anyone, I think. And so it takes someone who really has a commitment to make mm-hmm. those changes. And I always say it's a process. It's not something that you throw at them at one time and hope that they'll do it. It has to be something that you work continually together with. and make those changes slowly over time. And it may be no more than cutting the salt by 1/4 teaspoon the first time and seeing if it really makes a difference, and then slowly cutting back to where it may be no salt added. But you have to start somewhere, and it takes infinite patience to help people to make the difference. The main thing I see, though, is working with the young people. If you're having your children eat the way that you did or your grandparents did, the problems that you are having will visit them. The genetics is there. Yeah. And so you have to make that decision that you are going to protect your family and that they're worth the effort.
That's Connie Crawley, a dietitian based in Athens. Strade Anderson is the African Heritage and Health Program Coordinator with the nutrition nonprofit group Old Ways. And also filmmaker Byron Hurt, his documentary Soul Food Junkies is now streaming on Netflix. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. The Civil War may have first divided and then reunited the country, but it also led to an economic split between North and South. Decades of poverty followed the war in the South, and now new research suggests the stress from all those years of poverty had other consequences. For example, heart disease. That's the conclusion of an ecological study by Richard Steckel. He's an economics professor at Ohio State University and joins me now. Good morning, Rick.
Hello. Glad to be here.
And also with us is George Howard. He's a professor of biostatistics at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Hi there, George.
Good morning. Honored to be here also.
So, Rick and George, very few of our listeners are either biostatisticians or economics professors. So I want to, because I am not either, I want to kind of walk us through what you studied and what you found, Rick, to help people really understand what you're saying, because it's a pretty surprising conclusion here. So let's start first with the connections with the Civil War. And one of the first ones is poverty. How does the poverty that followed the Civil War connect to today's heart disease?
Well, it would be through what's called the fetal origins hypothesis, or the idea that conditions in utero shape the construction of major biological organs. And if the placenta, which transmits information about present conditions and also past conditions, anticipates a life of poverty, it will prepare the emerging child for that kind of environment. So the environment of the South, and I was, by the way, born in the South, as was my mother, born in Georgia, Milledgeville specifically for me.
Well, lots of Milledgeville people today.
Oh, yes.
Keep going.
And those generations of poverty, which I witnessed as a young child myself, visiting my grandfather in the 1950s and 1960s, was followed by robust economic growth and social change, especially in the 60s, 70s, and 1980s. So children born in the 40s, 50s, 60s of Southern mothers who had intergenerational experiences with poverty, like my case, ended up with, according to the theory, poorly developed structures such as the cardiovascular system, the liver, the kidneys, the pancreas, that did not anticipate a luxurious life in terms of diet or what we call net nutrition.
Well, let me take this to George here real quick, Rick. You know, George, there, with the 10 states with the highest rate of death from heart disease recently, all but two of them are in the South. So do you buy this connection between someone who is born to a Southern, possibly poor mother, and having a weaker cardiovascular system?
Actually, I want to compliment, is it Dr. Sneakle? Am I saying that right? By the way, am I close?
Dr. Steckel. That's
Steckel,
right.
I beg your pardon, sir. Anyway, no, I think these innovative hypotheses are exciting and offer new directions. I think that it's unlikely that the higher mortality in the South is attributable to any single source. Rather, I think it's a soup of many potent parts. There have been at least 10 published theories for why really more stroke than heart disease is higher in the South. There's actually very little agreement between particularly at the state level, between regions that are high in heart disease and high in stroke. And actually, the South is really much more, the burden of stroke in the South is really much larger than the burden of heart disease. And the exciting paper that is before us today was actually looking at all cardiovascular diseases, which would be everything from childhood heart disease to adult heart disease and stroke and hypertension and a number of other vascular conditions. And so I think it's important not to say heart disease in this discussion.
However, George, a number of studies have found that people who were in utero during famines, for example, do have more cardiovascular disease or diabetes. So can we connect cardiovascular problems in general with if the mother has issues with poverty?
Right. No, absolutely. I think it is certainly a contributor. I think perhaps the point where we disagree is whether it's a major contributor or a relatively minor contributor. The studies that have shown that have required a large sample size, and other factors in those same studies have played a larger role, such as adult hypertension and diabetes, where it could be argued that the adult hypertension and diabetes are a product of the in utero, but even that is a relatively weaker link.
Okay, so Rick, then take us back to some of the other, because you discuss other results or effects of the Civil War that may have set the South up to suffer from cardiovascular disease and heart attack especially. What were they?
Well, smoking, obesity, if Dr. Howard is speaking of current conditions, those are certainly relevant in our study, and I couldn't agree more with him that many factors are involved. There is a soup, as he says. But I think these in utero conditions have been neglected in many studies. And as a social scientist, I'm trying to bring this historical background, these long-term conditions, to the picture, understanding not just heart disease, but as he says, stroke and diabetes as well. I believe they're all connected. They're interrelated. They have the same similar origin in terms of in utero conditions.
So then, George, let's take that. What about obesity? There are higher rates of obesity in the South. We just had a long conversation about soul food. It's long roots in the South and the use of bacon grease and cheese and all kinds of fried okra and fried chicken. Is there a chance that obesity rates, which do have a direct connection to cardiovascular disease?
It's interesting. I think that you might have bought into, if we say, where are the data that do support that Southerners are more obese and do support that Southerners eat differently? If you talk about the data that support that Southerners are more obese, those are largely from, as the paper before us, come from the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, a telephone interview, a wonderful telephone interview conducted by the CDC in Atlanta. And so basically this is an interview where people call up and say a long list of questions, including among them is how much do you weigh and how tall are you? And on the basis of that, you can calculate obesity. It turns out that if you look at studies that that actually put people on scales, in other words, actually weigh them and actually measure how tall they are, the highest obesity rates are actually not in the South. They're actually in the mid-central U.S., the Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan actually have higher obesity rates. And this is both on the basis of NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Survey, and also a study that I'm part of called REGARDS, where we actually put people on scales. Self-reported weight is the number two lied about question that, not surprisingly, how much do you weigh, Linda? And it's the number two lied about question.
Wait, if that's number two, what's the number one lied about question?
And how much do you get paid to work for National Public Radio? the perception that the Southerners are more obese, I think there's growing data that is a misperception, probably regional differences in self-report. Perhaps Southerners are more open to, we also underreport our weight, but we underreport it less than people from other regions is what the data seems
to suggest. So we all lie about our weight, but if we're 30 pounds overweight in the South, we'll say we're 20 pounds overweight, but if I'm 30 pounds overweight in the North, I'll say I'm 10 pounds overweight. Is that what you're saying?
Right, well said.
Okay. Then, Rick, let me bring that back to you in terms of the connections that you have made between obesity in the South and cardiovascular disease.
Well, I can't challenge Dr. Howard's data or statement. I don't have the evidence he's referring to. I'm just working with what's available from
the CDC.
The Vital Statistics System. So, and we have those data at the state level, and they do clearly show Southerners more obese. But it's not just the South, as he says. There are Nevada and other, especially at the county level, parts of the United States that have high rates of obesity as well. So it's not peculiar to the South, but it's prominent there.
It seems to me, and Rick, you can correct me if I'm boiling your theory down to too simplistic of a statement, but it seemed to me that a lot of what is at the heart of what your theory is that the Civil War kind of devastated the South economically, both on a larger level in terms of businesses, but also on personal levels, that suddenly there were people who were very, very poor, and that had implications that lasted for generations and may be lasting now, and that poverty is not good for your health.
Well, certainly intergenerational poverty followed by prosperity. In the South, industrialized in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, income growth in the South was much higher than the national average. The South caught up. They're almost even with the rest of the country now. But there are, of course, pockets of poverty in the South. That's the connection I'm emphasizing here. I think the data are quite good on Southern poverty after the Civil War. There was a lot of destruction. Much of the war was fought in the South. The banks failed, so on and so forth. There was huge institutional change, the demise of slavery and whatnot. And the income wealth data that we have show the South beginning to catch up in the 1940s and 1950s. And that's what animated my study. I'm an economic historian. I see those trends. I see the map of high rates of heart disease, also diabetes, in the South, and I wonder why. Is there a historical connection? That's the link I'm making. It's unfortunate we don't have more intergenerational, what I call longitudinal data to pin down some of these effects. I'd love to have it, and we are preparing grant studies to proposals to do that.
So George, let me take that to you then. Is there a nugget here for further research in that, as Rick is saying, poverty followed by prosperity may not lead to the best lifestyles or cardiovascular health?
Right. No, and I also want to agree with almost everything that's being said by Rick. Poverty is an incredibly powerful force. Both poverty and education, for that matter, another factor considered in his work, are incredible predictors of disease. And I think that we're so far away from understanding the differences, the contributors to geographic patterns of disease. I think there's decades of important research that is really critically important. If you focus on stroke only, the cost of the excess stroke in the South, there are about 20 to 30,000 extra stroke events in the South every year, which is I'm from a town of 8,000 people, and so if you talk about 30,000 people, it's a large number. It costs about $140,000 to have a stroke now. It's a very expensive disease. And so we're talking about this disparity, not the cost of stroke, but the cost of the disparity that Rick is writing about, is in the billions of dollars every year in terms of public health burden. And so this is a huge and important question with much work left to be done.
And it seems to me, George, that Rick is kind of at the leading edge in terms of trying to figure out why the South has particular incidences of disease, or as you say, higher incidences of of stroke and heart attack?
It's certainly an interesting theory he's put forth. There are a couple of things to consider. First of all, the biggest disparity is on stroke, and that's the area that I happen to know the most about. And the stroke disparity goes back to at least 1940 and probably far before that. And so the idea that poverty could be a driving force, I think, could not agree more. The concept that it's the change in poverty is might take a little bit more work. But in addition to Rick, there are also a lot of other people working in this area, and there are at least 10 published theories for why there's more mortality in the South. And this is being done by a fairly large. I'm part of a group of people that is really working to try to understand these huge geographic disparities.
And Rick, is this the beginning of research into trying to figure out why there are these disparities in the South, or do you feel like you've found your answer?
Oh no, this is just the beginning, and I would say that our results are suggestive. They're not conclusive because we're working with such what we call aggregate data or state-level data. It doesn't really prove the connection because there are many other things that could go on here. And even with respect to income, which we use to measure change in the South, it's a proxy or a variable that consolidates or captures many changes in family labor force participation, the work effort that's required of children and parents, its levels of education that change. There are many things going on in the South, and we think income captures a lot of these changes. So it's not just income per se. It's many other things, too.
Rick Steckel is an economics professor at Ohio State University. George Howard is a professor of biostatistics at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Thanks so much to both of you. That's our show for today. As always, though, we'd love to hear from you. And tomorrow we're going to talk about changes to the PSAT. That's the pre-SAT test. Did you take the SAT, or maybe your kid did? Tell us if you think we perhaps put too much emphasis on these big, tough tests like the SAT or ACT, or are they an accurate measure of a student's potential? Call us at 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk, or post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.